The next case is 96-1990, Richland County Bar Association versus Marcus Allen Wolf. Whether the panel believed that Ms. Clifton's changed story, which seemed to jive with the respondent's story, that there really was consensual contact here, and that even though there was a misdemeanor conviction for misdemeanor, do you have any thoughts about that, or why they?
The panel had to believe that at the point of the hearing that in fact the sexual relationship was consensual. That was the only testimony for the panel at that time. If you go back, and again, this is a very convoluted situation. If you go back to the emergency report, which is part of the materials, you will see that it was originally reported as an assault. And again, rape, I think, is probably too harsh a term, but again, it was reported as an assault. I think that the panel did have to believe at that point that the relationship was consensual. That was the last story told by Ms. Clifton to Judge Lewis and the special prosecutor, and also the story that was told by Attorney Wolf.
It was consensual, and yet he was found guilty of sexual imposition.
Pled guilty.
Okay.
That's the situation.
Yeah.
Was the rationale because she was in
the criminal charge was originally the lease goes through and it is difficult to exact all of the details, but what seems to have happened was that the plenty of witnesses, of course, recanted at that point. The prosecutor's case for the felony is going downhill. The plea bargain was offered, and the judge permitted the special prosecutor to amend the charges. So there was court involvement in the amendment of these charges. It was not a unilateral prosecutorial decision to come in and say, "Judge, I'm amending these charges." He, as I recall, essentially orally moved the court to accuse the charges. The court so allowed. So there was involvement of both the prosecutor, defense lawyer, and the judge at that time.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, if both parties now are saying it's essential, what was the underlying culpability then?
That is a difficult issue in this case because, again, part of the plea bargain was struck, and the judge indicates in his in the transcript in the sentencing there still are problems with this, and I can't pick it out right now, but if you read that, you will see that the judge was still not convinced that there wasn't criminal conduct. And again, I think everybody was convinced at that point that it wasn't felony conduct, but the judge was allowing this reduction to a misdemeanor based upon the facts. We have filed objections in three different areas. We believe that...
Counsel,
yes.
I think you're arguing that the panel dismissed the charges relating to moral turpitude.
No, they didn't. They didn't address those charges.
Yes, that's because they thought that the...
I don't think so. This is akin to a court of appeals not addressing an assignment of error. Simply wasn't addressed. It wasn't addressed at the hearing panel level, and it wasn't addressed at the board level. And here we are. And again, we objected that they did not find that these crimes were crimes of moral turpitude.
What about the argument that this that the rule was
no longer her attorney?
Okay, there I have a problem with. And that was handled, or that was addressed in a very cursory manner by the hearing panel. The hearing panel clearly stated that the divorce was over and the fees paid. And again, I think when we look at disciplinary matters, I don't think that the bench and the bar can in good conscience make that test in this type of case. Don't we have to look at the reasonable client or the reasonable person out there and ask the question, did this person, did this client believe that this person was still his or her attorney? If you look at Sergeant Kirkman, who was the layperson on the panel, if you look at his questioning to Attorney Wolf, he kind of backs into it, he kind of gets back into that issue and says, "Attorney Wolf, wouldn't Ms. Clifton assume at that point that you were still her lawyer?" And the ultimate answer was yes. And I think as a group action bar, in this kind of process, we can't use a watershed date as we do with a malpractice claim. We can't use a watershed date and say, okay, at that time, that hour, the attorney-client relationship was ended, and therefore, all this stuff is okay.
That's nice.
And the court has to look at that, and that's a very important issue in this case.
Just got to find
it. How do we determine that date?
Well, I think you have to look at it from the point of view of the client. Here's a client who is, by Mr. Wolf's own story, if you look at the story that he tells Detective Wesley, it's very interesting. He lies to the police officer, but he lies in 4.5 pages of single-spaced type. He talks about the dilemma that this woman has. She's got these emotional problems. She's been hospitalized. If you look at the emergency room records, she's on a laundry list of medication, and she's got custody problems. The crux of this case was a custody problem. The decree goes on November 7th, as I recall. This incident happens November 14th or 16th. Would this woman reasonably assume at that point that Marcus Wolf was still her lawyer?
Then you're saying that from the facts involved in this case, the client would reasonably assume that the lawyer would be continuing representing her in other problems that came from the divorce.
Yes, I think that's part and parcel, but I don't think it's quite that simple. In a domestic relations area, there is often close to free work, and especially with my children. Well, let's assume for a moment that you've got a personal injury cell. Everybody gets it, they saw
that they're about to look at the facts here and recognize because of the lady's... Was he clearly aware, first of all, of her fragile emotional status and her treatment and those kinds of things?
I don't know whether we got into the details, but he can't have it both ways. When he gives a statement to officer, whether the detective, whether he says she's emotionally unstable,
yeah.
Proves to the point, she goes to the hospital and says, I've been sexually assaulted, and then he can't. Knew or should have known, yes.
We know lots of folks that we think could be a little more emotionally stable. That's different than somebody who's to the point that they've had a hospital stay.
He knew that she had been in hospital.
And that's established, didn't it?
I believe that is established on every ground.
Then, I guess we need a little help in, it's not just this case, but it's always what disciplinary counsel, everyone's looking to for guidance when issues somewhat similar arise. How do we deal with the delicate nature of when it is permissible for a lawyer to have consensual conduct with a client? Say it's a tax client. Because then once a year, does the income tax deduction. I assume we don't want to be saying that the lawyer can't develop
a relationship with the client.
That's right.
And I think in some states have dealt with it on a rulemaking basis. I think Keith Kettlewell talks about that in some parts of that. But here, you've got the extra added criminal aspect of it. I don't know that you have to get to it. But even if you don't agree with my position there, look at Bloor, which was unfortunately decided right on the heels of our hearing on this thing. And that didn't involve any criminal conduct, but it involved a substantial sanction by this court against Mr. Bloor. And this court said in that case that you have an inherently unequal position between the criminal attorney and the accused that makes this really bad. And in this case, I don't know that these facts are as aggregated as those of Bloor, but it's not much different when you have the attorney for a divorce client. You're the same.
There's a continuum here, and that guy who's down at the jail is an extreme, I guess. None of us would have expected to have happened. Hearing this conduct, I suppose, doesn't surprise us that much that may regrettably happen from time to time. And then there's somewhere on out here something that we might all agree is perfectly appropriate.
Well, I think, though, when you look at the entire set of facts, and again, taking away the line of the police officers, you've got a woman who is emotionally unstable by the admission and the direct statement of the respondent. You have an attorney-client relationship which may, by malpractice definition, be over at that point. But the respondent himself admits any question to Officer Gerber in the transcript that, yes, I assume, or I believe she probably would have, but I was still the lawyer.
But, they're in the office. I mean, of course, he admits it. But here's a lawyer in his office with a known unstable client who the basis for our sanctioning this kind of conduct is because of the trust situation. So that underlies this whole thing. I think we have to think about that there's you're in a position of trust that can be abused.
If the court sanctions this type of conduct just because the entry is not able to pay,
thank you, Mr. McIntyre. Mr. Kettlewell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, please, the Court. Let me address some of the questions that have been raised with the body concerning the court. One was Mr. Wolf aware of her emotional status? Yes, he was aware of it. Good knowledge as anyone because he's been representing her in a divorce case where custody of children was an issue and where she received joint custody of her child. He was aware of the diagnosis of depression and of medical history of depression related to my brief, which is Dr. Massey's letter, in which he reflects that there was no emotional or service problems that was stemming from this relationship. And so yes, he was aware, and he also knew that she was not having a type of severe emotional trauma or interfered with her judgment. I'd like to point out, I believe it was Justice Stratton, I believe, asked the question as to the criminal charges, Justice Lawyer as well. The original criminal charges included an allegation that she could not resist or consent. The second one, that she could not advise or trade herself with the nature of control or conduct as a result of emotional condition. But as the evidence came in on this case, it became clear that that was not something to be established in the criminal cases. The prosecutor there has submitted a charge letter on behalf of Mr. Pope, as Detective Wendling submitted an affidavit, both saying he should not lose his license. These are the people that were involved directly in this case. Indeed, every judge in that county, with the exception of the sentencing judge, either appeared live as a charge letter, Mr. Pope, or gave a charge letter on behalf of Mr. Pope. And every judge, including the sentencing judge, refers cases to him and appoints him to take cases today, 2 years, 3 months almost a day after this indiscretion occurred, and then also after the lying occurred after that. Why did he plead to the sexual imposition in this mindless conduct? I think the answer is very simple. We have publicity going, we have a situation going. If there was an opportunity that the defense counsel approached him with, here is a plea that can be done, and this is for publicity stops. To the extent publicity can stop, it stopped at that point. And they agreed to it, he agreed to it. And that was what they eliminated all these other allegations, took it down to the M1, and the case was done. Whether that was in his best ultimate interest or not, I don't know, but it was a judgment that had to be made then on the advice of counsel that was made and followed up on. And as Mr. McIntyre pointed out, this was not a plea taken in a vacuum. The judge inquired. The judge states on the record, I went to Netflix and I talked with her in the sentencing, the same thing. The judge inquired and pursued her at that time. Her affidavit, incidentally, says that she never said she was raped. She didn't go to a hospital immediately. She went to the hospital shortly after that morning, and she went to the hospital primarily to have examination. It was not safe sex. And she went in for those purposes. And this case then mushroomed to where it appeared to be a rape charge. And her affidavit says she encouraged the detective and the prosecutor numerous times to drop the charges, not proceed with a criminal charge. So this got started. It was a personal indiscretion that occurred some days after the divorce was over, and it went off from there. Now, I would like to point out a couple of additional things. I'm not certain, I don't want to answer an additional question, or at least a comment from Justice Sweeney. You know, what could be a watershed date? Well, this court considered, I believe, having a per se sexual relationship with a client. Many jurisdictions consider that. Most have not adopted it. And Mr. McIntyre is correct. I do address that in CLE materials at national level and state level. It's a very difficult rule to have because human beings are out there and sophisticated tax lawyer representing sophisticated business person. They have a relationship. I would suggest that the standard that has worked for years is the DR 5101, is an interview with the independent professional judgment of the lawyer representing the client, or 1102A5. The lawyer's conduct gets to the point that interferes and prejudices the administration of justice. And there is not one allegation of any interference with independent professional judges. So if you are representing a client and the match strikes, and I don't know when, it certainly wasn't planned by either of these two to happen on that point. She's coming from something else in his building. He has a hearing to attend very shortly. Walks into the office, and they both say this, walks into the office, but the door is closed, not there for the purpose of signing papers or anything else, and bang, a spark went off. Now, it could have happened between the lawyer and the client, after a PTA meeting. It could have happened after a soccer game. It could have happened at dinner after a consultation. I don't know, no one else knows when the spark will happen. tomorrow, I think you ought to give real strong consideration to getting out of this case, let somebody else come in. And what did Mr. Wolf do? He ceased his representation. They continued the relationship for 2 years and remain friends today.
Was that, is that in the record that he ceased his representation? How do we know?
Yes, sir, it's in the record. He no longer he discontinued any representation on any matters.
He was the subject of a criminal complaint by her at that point.
Oh, yes.
Right?
So yeah, but she was, but she in fact did ask him to continue to represent her, and he said no. And he said, this is all cloud, and you and I are having a continuing relationship. And no, certainly he was subject to a complaint.
They were having a continuing relationship while she was filing a criminal complaint?
They said, Your Honor, they continued. If this all resulted, Mr. Wolf ended up having a divorce. He and Ms. Clifton continued to have a relationship throughout the criminal matter, throughout the discipline matter, and for some period of time thereafter. It's a very close relationship. It is now a friendship relationship at this point in time. And that's been ongoing throughout. This wasn't something that was planned. And for the watershed, I don't know. What if it was a month later and they met at the soccer game? They went out for coffee. The fact that it happened in the office, poor taste, indiscretion. Yeah.
Well, what are you suggesting the sanction ought to be?
I had recommended at the hearing that it be a public reprimand, Your Honor. When the panel came back, and they came back unanimously, and they had very strong language, they were unanimously impressed with the obvious candor, truthfulness, and remorse of Mr. Wolf. And they said 6 months with all of it saved. I discussed this with Mr. Wolf. We certainly weren't going to file any objections at that point. He wants to practice law. He's been practicing law for 2 years and 2 months since this happened. And judges are signing in cases, and he does not want to lose one day. And that is his objective. That's my objective. We didn't object. The objection, the first issue I raised in my brief, was whether or not the bar should be allowed to appeal the dismissal of count one. Dismissal of the count having to do with the sexual relationship. If our rule would say that if the board dismisses the case, then that's it. We notify the parties and it's out. And we're in this thing, well, they dismissed part of it. The words are dismissed the complaint. And I'm not sure whether a complaint and a count are different. I think this court needs to examine that issue and make a determination. Had they dismissed everything, it's clear they could have brought it up. But the bar is arguing at this point in time that there was an error of judgment by the panel. There was a question raised at the panel, and the board considered every charge. And if you read the transcript, you read the complaint, you read the answer, there's no question that they all knew what the charges were in your agency. All of them knew it was a charge. And they did not find a violation of A3. And this court said in the Burkhart case very, very clearly that when there is illegal conduct that has been led up to it,
by the time the board gets to this, are they influenced by the fact give me an idea of the time frame. The criminal matter is completed?
Yes, sir.
And is there testimony at the board that this has become an ongoing relationship at the time he's before the panel?
At the time he's before the panel? Yes, sir. That testimony.
So they're romantically involved at the time the board is looking at this.
By the time the panel hearing came up, Mr. Wolf was divorced, was either final or very near final. He and Ms. Clifton's relationship was continuing.
And was that,
that was in the record.
That was in the record.
Yes, sir.
That he's terminated his marriage and this has matured beyond something inappropriate in the office to something that appears to have some future as a lasting relationship. And that was the status in the record at the time of the hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would help explain, I suppose, the panel at least looked at it that way at that point in time.
But the panel had all these medical records in front of them. And I would not insult that panel to suggest that they didn't read them and study them. They knew what the initial intake at the hospital had been, what those nurses' reports said. They knew that she made statements to Detective Lane. They also knew what she said. And they knew what she said to Detective Wendling. There was a lie in this case. Mr. Wolf has always acknowledged he lied. I could call up a 40-year-old hand in a cookie jar. He was accused by Detective Wendling and was asked to come in and give a statement, and he was told that he was accused of rape. And he did what maybe many people would do, but it was certainly wrong. And he acknowledges that. He has been sanctioned criminally for that. He will be disciplined for that. And he accepts that and has from day one. But he says, I didn't rape her. And he said, she's not real stable. I mean, he just went berserk. And he was asked under oath, if that statement had been given to you to sign, would you have signed it? He said, absolutely not. He said, I knew I lied. I walked out of there. What should the sanction for that lie be?
Your
Honor, again, I have recommended a public reprimand. I think it's very distinguishable from criminal law and Green cases. We do not have a lie to a client or to a court. We have a lie to a police officer who has put in the record.
And we have an attorney who's been in the newspaper, I assume, pleading guilty to
obstruction, falsification, and sexual imposition. And that same attorney had character letters and testimony from 40-plus members of the bar and all but one judge, and they're still using them and appointing the cases.
Were the judges, I'm just curious, were the judges subpoenaed by any chance?
Oh, yes, every judge that appears was subpoenaed.
Good. You would do that, I'm sure. Good.
Counsel, are you saying that if he told the truth, that when he went to the police, asked them about this alleged rape, he said, wait a minute, I had sexual relations with her, but it was consensual, we wouldn't be here today?
I think there's a reasonable chance that that's true. Had he been truthful with the detective, this would have lost a lot of steam real fast. We would not have the falsification at all. We would have had, let's get to the bottom of what the sexual conduct is, and it might well have quickly come out to, okay, this was a consensual relationship between two adults. But what they ended up with was criminal charges that were very serious, alleging that she didn't have to, and then as the facts came out, it came down to the two misdemeanor charges.
Who's the complainant? Who's the complainant here? The Bar Association?
I believe the relator initiated this on their own. Yes, the Bar Association initiated it on their own. The complainant, by affidavit, says shouldn't lose his license. The prosecutor, the detective, and a great number of other persons. Including, and what I think is important is Lieberman Brown, Sergeant Burton, who is by now maybe in the current, I'm not sure.
Not yet?
Okay. It'll be a good one. I mean, these people, they didn't just sit back. They grilled Mr. Wolf. They put him to the test. And they asked him questions. Sergeant Burton did ask him, is there a possibility that a client walking into your office this shortly after the divorce was final might think you're still the attorney? And he said, yeah, that's a possibility. But he didn't represent her after that, and that divorce was final. And he stayed out of it, It was a personal indiscretion. It was poorly done by all involved. And it has resulted in significant other sanctions, criminal sanctions, publicity, discipline sanctions. And Mr. Wolf has gotten on with his life. He has been in custody of his own children. This is not a man. Community for the public need be feared of. I respectfully submit that the purpose of discipline is to protect the public and the profession. I believe in this instance, when you look at the totality of the circumstances and how this happened, you try to come up with some watershed rule, I don't know what it is. We simply can't. Man cannot regulate every bit of conduct of man or woman. Can't be done. And discipline serves a great purpose to protect the public from dishonest, devious, cheating, lying, stealing attorneys. This was a personal indiscretion. And it happened. And the case law cited to you. There's cases where people, lawyers, have had a relationship and continued to have a relationship and gotten public record. The Resnick case, when I cited it, I respectfully submit that no sign.
Kettlewell.
Thank you.
Mr. McIntyre, you saved about a minute and a half of your time.
Very briefly, the grievance committee, the certified grievance committee, didn't make any of the choices in this case. All of the choices that were made to have relationships, to lie to Officer Welling, to plead guilty to these misdemeanors were made before the case even got to us. And I think that's extremely important. Here we are. We are saddled with an individual who has publicly pled guilty to two serious misdemeanors. And I personally feel, and I think the committee feels also, that you can't go behind those pleas, as has happened here, and explain them away and say, oh, you know, gee, just a plea bargain. And I did that to save my family, to embarrass my mother and my family. I think that's an important aspect of this case. We didn't ask him to plead guilty to those things. The other thing that strikes me about the case and the argument that we just had, I don't think the convention bar can have a rule about romantic relationships and says you can make an ex post facto determination that it's okay until you butt up against Cannon 5. I don't think we can have a rule that says that we assess it in 2020 hindsight. I think that's important. It's got to be a rule that, as I've argued here, that you look at the point of view of the client and see what happens.
Counsel, I'm more troubled out of you about where does it become acceptable? Let's take the divorce situation. Say it wasn't custody, say it was a divorce here. The divorce, there's the final hearing. The client and two of her friends show up at the courthouse, dressed to kill. They adjourn to the Holiday Inn for a celebration afterwards and to tell the attorney, you know, when you're done at the office, why don't you come on over? And one thing leads to another and you end up with dinner and adjourning to her home instead. That crossed the line?
Very, very difficult. Yes, I think it does cross the line because of the proximity. And I would have to ask, was there a custody dispute, and are there children involved, or why there was reason to believe that it would be further close to
you? So it was just going to have to deal with this fact pattern at a time. I guess what I'm asking you for, is there a bright line that you think works?
No, I don't think there is a bright line, but I think we have to. I think this court has to find a line somewhere. I mean, you talked about a score. That was clearly inappropriate. What if she had been released on bail? That was clearly inappropriate.
That was easy.
That was much, much easier. In this case, it's easier than your hypothetical because of the situation and the surrounding facts.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.